I guess that's our cue, folks. Good morning, or good afternoon. Sorry, I just feel like the morning still somehow. My name is Sean Farnell. I'm going to be moderating this session, which is all about the various ways that the role festivals have in the distribution chain is rapidly changing. And we have three panelists here. We're going to talk about these things for the next hour. We'll talk a little bit amongst ourselves to start, folks, but then we're happy to get to the floor as quickly as possible. If you have a question, raise your hand. We'll get you a microphone, and we'll try our best to answer your question clearly and articulately. From my far right, we have Chris Horton, who runs Artist Services at Sundance, and of course Sundance very active on the distribution front with their Sundance Selects label and other...
That's actually IFC Films, so that's totally different.
That's a branding thing, totally different from Artist Services, but we'll figure out the distinction with Chris. Nancy Schaefer of Tribeca. Tribeca also active on this front, and Nancy will tell us how. Nancy, one of the founders of the one and only South by Southwest Film Festival, folks, so Nancy back home. And Jason Janego from Radius. Do I have that right, Jason?
That's
Radius.
Correct. That's correct.
That is correct. I've just learned this. This is the label that Jason and Tom Quinn went over from Magnolia to found within the Weinstein Company distribution. Jason will tell us what Radius is up to, how they're approaching festivals in terms of their acquisitions and distribution strategy, and how things are changing on that front for them. So I think, Chris, I'll just start back over with you. Give us a sense of what Artist Services is, what your mandate is in the context of Sundance Institute in terms of helping filmmakers get their films out there.
Sure. Well, Artist Services is about a year old. It's a new initiative within the Sundance Institute, which is the nonprofit arts organization that, of course, puts on the Sundance Film Festival every year. And with Artist Services, we're really trying to address all of these shifts and changes in distribution, changes in the way films get financed, and how do we apply our brand to some of those trends in a way that can amplify a lot of those opportunities for our filmmakers. And in doing so, we sort of fulfill in a lot of ways the original mission that Redford laid out over 30 years ago, which is connecting artists to audiences. And how do we do that with these emerging on-demand digital platforms? How do we do that with new ways of creative financing? And so what we did was strike a series of partnerships in the creative funding space, in creative distribution, in creative marketing. A little bit over a year ago at last year's festival, the 2011 Sundance Film Festival, we announced a partnership with Kickstarter, and we became essentially their first ever curatorial partner. And what that means is that any Sundance alumni, whether it's a filmmaker from 1989 who has a great idea for a new space age can opener, or whether it's a filmmaker from this year's festival whose film may not have gotten distribution and they maybe want to raise some money to finance P&A to do theatrical on their own, we're able to curate that project on our subpage, which gets the film better real estate, better promotion, better visibility, and offer guidance and support and coaching. As my colleague Joe Beyer likes to say, we become the Mick to the filmmaker's Rocky. You know, we're encouraging them along the way. We're prodding them. And as a result, over the last year, we've supported about 65 projects, which have netted about $1.6 million to Sundance artists. And it, you know, ranges from about $3,000 for post-production financing campaigns to a short film, all the way up into a project that just completed its goal about a week and a half ago called Boy, which raised about $110,000 to do a really nice self-release theatrical campaign. So that partnership's going really well. And what we also do in the distribution space, and I'll just stress that Sundance is not acting as a distributor here. We knew we needed to get into this space, but we knew it was fundamental for us as a nonprofit, as an arts organization, to let artists retain ownership of their rights as they navigate this landscape with our branding support. And so what we did was essentially strike a series of deals that are focused on two trends that we're noticing right now. The one trend, which has been happening for a really long time, is that far too many films play Sundance and never get any distribution. They may only be seen in their 10 days in the mountains of Utah, and that's unacceptable to us. That's a violation of our mission. The other trend that we're noticing is that there's a lot of films that might be getting traditional distribution offers, but whether the filmmaker wants to retain more ownership or wants more of the upside of the revenue streams, they're embarking on self-distribution strategies. And so we're also trying to build distribution highways that can help those films as well. So the end result now is a series of deals that we've done with iTunes, Amazon VOD, Hulu, Netflix Streaming, the YouTube rental store, and Sundance Now, which is not connected to the Institute, but is a new and emerging platform connected to IFC and the Sundance Channel, where any film that has ever played our festival or any project that's ever been supported by our documentary or feature film or Native Labs, going all the way back, is now automatically eligible for distribution on those platforms. And we do that with a very special arrangement through New Video Group, which is an aggregator based in New York, that handles the licensing, because we at the Institute are not about to hire 10 people to do the encoding, and as a nonprofit, we can't really be handling the accounting from these platforms. And they've brokered down very special terms that offer an insanely low percentage as a distribution fee and absolute ownership in our artist's possession. So that means that the most random, obscure film from this year's festival that may not have ever gotten distribution at all is now able to get up onto iTunes with Sundance branding. So too could, the biggest film with the biggest stars if they wanted to take advantage of our deal, because it offers the cleanest, purest revenue split. And we'll see how that shakes out, but for now we're really content to, really be helping a lot of these films that tell very unique stories that in the past had no avenues for distribution. And so on January 17th, we launched the first 13 titles, the first films to be taking advantage of these deals, and launched them basically to any consumer with access to the internet across this country, which is amazing. And we're really pleased. A lot of these films were films that played the festival a year ago and never got distribution, and are now able to get out there in front of audiences.
Now, you use the word distribution a lot in that very good overview of all your activities, but you also said you're not acting as a distributor. Tell me how you distinguish between the activities, which seem a lot like distribution, and wanting to not be a distributor. Where's that line?
Well, it means that we've built the highways for distribution,
right,
where the filmmaker can automatically tap into it, but a distributor by definition takes ownership of distribution.
It's about the rights. Who owns the rights?
It's about who owns the rights. And you could argue that in some senses New Video is fulfilling that duty by virtue of their licensing across each of those platforms. But we were really explicit in brokering the deal that our filmmakers do with New Video that they emphatically own their rights. And that, New Video services are purely relegated just to the licensing. So they're not marketing. They're not allocating costs that can be advanced and recouped from any gross that comes in, which are things that traditional distributors do. So ultimately, at the end of the day, what this is self-distribution. With our branding, with our help, with our support, with our resources, we're just trying to make it feel a lot less like self-distribution.
So you're leveraging your brand and your curation to create a bit more space for these films that don't have space in the marketplace. What is typically the entry point for filmmakers wanting to get involved in your program?
Well, we're open. This deal that we have is available to a couple thousand films. And we are technically blind as to, which films can access it. Some of the older titles, one of the most frustrating things about my job is, getting phone calls from filmmakers from 1986 who are so excited about this opportunity. My film has never seen the light of day since it played at the Egyptian in 1986. And all I have is a DVD. Can I still do it? So there's a lot of limitations when it comes to delivery. But, I would maybe look at the way we examine films from this year's festival. We're not necessarily out there making offers or bids because, our deal is consistent regardless of what the film is. It doesn't change. So a lot of filmmakers have naturally found out about this and are interested in it. Basically, every film that plays Sundance has active sales representation, and so I come from that world. I used to work for Cinetic Media in New York, which is a great sales agency. So I know that world. I can navigate that world. I can work with the sales agents if they're not getting offers. I can help them navigate split rights deals if they might license traditional television deals and have them figure out, iTunes is free and clear to do through your deal. So, it's a lot of that, sort of rights navigation, but you know, we're blind as to which films can take advantage of it.
Are your curators, your programmers, identifying films that would be good fits for the Sundance Selects?
Well, they've done that every year for the last 30 years.
Right.
You know, they've basically given me the easiest job on the planet in some
right.
ways.
All right, let's move on to what Tribeca's up to, Nancy. I think this has been a few years. You guys have been working on distribution activities in conjunction with also expanding your brand internationally in various ways to other festivals. Let's talk a little bit about exactly what you do in the world of film distribution.
I don't know that I can talk as much as Chris did, but I will try. He was very thorough. So I run the Tribeca Film Festival, and one of my sort of mantras over the years, and actually, first let me tell you that the mission for Tribeca as an organization is to increase the audience for independent film. So one of the things I've been saying to filmmakers for years is use film festivals, whatever film festivals you get into, as platforms for release, because this is a huge marketing opportunity, especially a festival like Tribeca or a festival like Sundance. That's more marketing than most theatrical releases get. So let's figure out how to use a festival as a marketing platform and release films off it. Well, no one paid any attention to me, so we, well, you know, some films obviously do use festivals as marketing platforms to release their films, but I wanted the littler indies to try to see how they could do that. So what we did is we started a distribution business, and we are a traditional distributor in many ways, unlike Sundance's artist services, but we're also non-traditional in many ways. So what we do is we find films from all over the world, not just from Tribeca, not just from all different festivals, and we release them year-round on VOD, theatrical, DVD, all of the normal ways, iTunes, Netflix, Showtime. And we're in 40 million homes, 40 million homes on VOD, and we do our VOD and our theatrical simultaneous day and date. So what that means is it's sort of a non-traditional distribution platform, but using the traditional methods, theatrical, VOD, DVD. Just the windows are changed. So, and our DVD deal is also with New Video, so we work with the same partners. And we have great distribution, and we launched this 2 years ago out of the festival, and then last year we went year-round. So we buy 26 to 28 films a year, and we release them across the board.
What are some titles that we might be familiar with recently that you've acquired?
We have Detachment out right now, which is Tony Kaye's new film with Adrian Brody. And we some of the bigger titles we showed are films called like Last Night with Keira Knightley. Sorry, I'm like having. The first year we launched with films like The Wild and Wonderful Whites of West Virginia, which actually is a great film. We have some genre titles like Grave Encounters, and so they really run the gamut. We're running showing a spectrum of work. We're showing foreign films. We're showing documentaries. We're showing bigger American indies. We're showing a whole spectrum because what the Our label is VOD driven, so we do everything, but obviously we're VOD driven. And what Comcast and the bigger cable operators are looking for us for is curatorship of a festival experience. So they're looking for that whole gamut of like festival show.
Now, traditionally, festivals have been have served two functions, well, many, but two primary functions in a distribution cycle. One, they've been a site in which distributors come to acquire new films, and then, as you mentioned, they've also been a marketing launch pad for films that are about to be released. Now that Tribeca is acquiring rights actively and is a distributor, do you find you're getting pushback from distributors? How do you manage those potential conflicts of interest between being a festival, sort of like a neutral party, and an active acquirer of films?
So we have a very it's very church and state. The programmers don't acquire the films, and the acquisitions people don't program the festival. So if, like all good acquisitions executives, they are tracking films, and they're tracking films that are showing at Sundance, and they're tracking films that might pop up at South by Southwest or pop up at Tribeca, they are constantly reaching out to those producers and sales agents to find out when they can see that film. They will probably, in many cases, have no idea that the festival has actually already watched it and maybe showing it on the other hand. So everyone's just doing their job and trying to find the best product possible for both the festival and for the distribution now.
So your programmers and then your acquisitions people aren't really like talking to each other that much. No. Okay, I want to come back to some of the things around around festival distribution, two different ways of doing it. Jason, tell us first a little bit about Radius. It's a very new entity within a Weinstein company. Tell us what you've been up to there.
Sure. Thanks, Sean. Radius TWC, I guess, is the official name now.
TWC?
And Radius,
right.
TWC, okay. If you're on Twitter and you like to follow these sort of things, please look up Radius TWC.
That's Radius TWC.
TWC.
Okay.
We are a boutique distribution company label within the Weinstein Company. We've been up and running for about 6 months now. I think my business partner, Tom Quinn, and I, we started the day before the Toronto Film Festival in September. So that's about 6 months. And over that time period, we've accumulated an initial slate of films, which we are very proud of. Four of those have been announced publicly. Two came out of the Sundance Film Festival this year. One is Bachelorette, which is arguably the most anticipated film at the festival this year, a film written and directed by Leslie Headland with Kirsten Dunst and Isla Fisher, Lizzie Kaplan. Another film came out of Sundance was Lay the Favorite, a Stephen Frears film starring Bruce Willis and Vince Vaughn. We acquired a film called Pusher, which is an English language remake of a trilogy of films directed by Nicholas Winding Refn that Tom and I worked on when we were at Magnolia several years ago. And most recently, and really exciting for us, is we announced the acquisition of the next film by Nicholas Winding Refn called Only God Forgives, which teams him up again with Ryan Gosling. They work together on Drive, and they're in Bangkok, Thailand, filming this film as we speak. The underworld in Thailand, and Ryan does a lot of Muay Thai boxing. So it should be really exciting. Yes.
As do I.
Yes.
No.
And that will be ready sometime in Q1 or Q2 of 2013.
Well, tell us how Radius is different than the Weinstein
sure.
company itself then.
Sure. The focus for Radius is on multi-platform distribution. So Tom and I were fortunate enough to have been at Magnolia in the early days when it was five people in a room. And we're there as that company grew. And as part of that growth period, we did a lot of experimentation with different types of release strategies. We came up, you know, in the traditional specialty distribution business, but as that business evolved and changed and became increasingly difficult to figure it out economically, we started playing around with this idea of shifting windows and video-on-demand, day-and-date releasing, pre-theatrical video-on-demand. We tried everything and kind of came up with a model that seemed to work a little bit. So we both felt that there was opportunities there, and as this business continues to evolve, to try and take this and push it as far as we possibly can. So we had an opportunity. We actually had several opportunities with a lot of different companies, studios, and we set up shop with Harvey and Bob. And so far, it's been really great.
You're still using festivals as part of your acquisitions
yes.
Strategy. Then how do you see what Sundance and Tribeca is up to, either complementing or possibly competing with what you do at a film festival?
Well, complementing, absolutely. I mean, look, we're all here, whether it's South By or Toronto or Sundance or Cannes or whatever, you're looking for product. And I'm sure that there will be some films that there will be some sort of overlap with something that we're interested in, that they're interested in. And, of course, those are the things that go into that deciding who ends up distributing the film. As far as utilizing festivals as a distribution platform, Tom and I are huge fans of it. We like the idea very much of the added exposure, the publicity, the ability. Tribeca is a wonderful example of being able to have a red carpet premiere in New York City with one of your films, with your talent coming in. The amount of press that you get for something like that is immeasurable. Same goes for Toronto and obviously Cannes, being if you have a worldwide presence. So we're huge fans of utilizing festivals as a way to launch a film or to enhance the film. I mean, even a film that may have premiered at another festival, if there are other opportunities in your sort of distribution cycle before you maybe get to your initial release, but there's a couple of festivals along the way that make sense for that particular film, absolutely. If it's another way to get exposure, get more people talking about it, especially in the space that we're all playing in, which is a space where you really aren't able to throw money at problems, So you want to utilize whatever opportunities present themselves as a way to sort of maximize the exposure you get and be really smart about it. And if you have an opportunity at a festival, could be South By, could be Tribeca, Sundance, to be able to sort of utilize the fact that you have all these people that are accumulated in one place and kind of get some additional media push or just people talking, especially in the social media world and seeing what's happening with all of the craziness at the Interactive next door. The opportunity to get people buzzed about a film, I mean, every little bit helps.
Given festivals give you a limited window in which to sort of capture that genie in the bottle, do you see some of the windows, and given that it's a big part of your own marketing and distribution strategy, do you see those windows collapsing between the time a film premieres at a film festival and the time you start exploiting it commercially as a distributor?
Sure, absolutely. I can think of something very specific that we're discussing right now where there may be an opportunity for a film to have have sort of a premiere at a festival either later this year or next year or something like that, and going with the release sort of to coincide exactly with the festival as a nice sort of, you know, push.
And this would be the world premiere of the film?
At least in our... It would be the world premiere, I think, yeah.
And so that limits the... that would mean the film probably would not play the festival circuit beyond that.
That's
initial...
That's correct.
So it could change the way films are circuited through the festival
potentially,
circuit.
Potentially, but those are... You know, we're talking about films that already have distribution in place. So
right.
the reason why they're playing that festival is different than a film that's coming looking for a distribution deal.
And Nancy, I'd put the same question, and Chris, to you. In terms of using your festival's brands to launch a film also commercially, do you see that squeezing this notion of a film playing through the festival circuit? In other words, if it launches at Tribeca and potentially goes day and date in conjunction with Tribeca, that pretty much takes it out of the film out of the festival world. Do you see that?
I don't know what else to say, but yes, it does. Once you've released a film, festivals don't want to show it anymore.
Are you getting any other pushback from other festivals then around you now being, you know, both of your festivals are two of the largest festivals in
Yeah, but we're not releasing all our films during the festival. I mean, we have a normal release slate for a company our size. I mean, you know, we're releasing films all year round, so there's only a handful that might release simultaneously with the festival.
Right.
Yeah, and Sundance is an interesting example, and I think IFC, both at Sundance and here at South By, experimented with some day-and-date cable VOD on a few titles, and they haven't done that in a couple of years. And I think, you know, Sundance, for a lot of filmmakers, it's the first festival in the calendar year. It's usually the world premiere of that film, and obviously it's in the filmmakers' and the sales agents' best interest to try to get the best possible deal that they can. We realize how important our festival is as an ecosystem for sales. But what I think is different right now, regardless of collapsing windows, is just how invested the filmmaking team has to be in anticipating the trajectory between the festival premiere and when that film ultimately will get distribution. And Jason, you'll remember this, you know, back when we were at Cinetic, how much things have changed. You know, it used to take a year for a film to get a deal, and we would be sweating so hard to get that deal done over the course of those 12 months, and the result would be the same. Now that is so, that just doesn't seem like a possibility, and the momentum and the trajectory is completely lost. And we used to discourage filmmakers from having trailers up of films. You know, we wanted distributors and audiences to come in to a screening at Sundance, let's say, with a completely open mind and a completely blank slate. And now if a filmmaker doesn't have trailers or doesn't have a social media presence and isn't invested with connecting with audiences in the lead up to Sundance, then that's not proving to distributors that the film has cultivated an audience, because otherwise it's just a random independent film with no stars, and that market is not strong. So the more that filmmakers can be leading up to the festival and building that audience and cultivating that audience in, you know, demonstrating that their film is different, because there's 113 films that premiered at Sundance this year, and not all of them are going to be getting distribution. Most of them won't, in fact. It's really up to the filmmakers and that team in a big way.
Well, I think you raised the key point and dilemma for independent filmmakers, especially those coming into a festival without distribution or even without a sales team behind them to sell the film. Often those filmmakers have also rushed to complete their film for a major premiere event. They're walking into the festival with almost complete films, and they're not ready for this other stuff. Do you suggest then filmmakers also pushing back their kind of window between completing a film and actually getting it ready for the festival circuit. In other words, make sure you're done. Give yourself 6 months to build this marketing campaign and then launch. You see that? Like, because there is a dilemma there. If they haven't built up the social marketing capital...
Well, I think, it really depends on, I think, what the scale and the budget and the expectation of the film and the investors are. And, you know, at Tribeca, at South by, at Sundance, you know, we see films in all stages of budget. And, you know, there's immense pressure in a lot of cases for films at sort of the higher, you know, budget tier for what, you know, can be triggered in terms of distribution. And a lot of times those films do rush to get ready for Sundance and premiere at Sundance. But, you know, there's still a very regulated world of agencies, enforcing those sales and, being pretty rigid on one form of distribution. But if that's not there, then the filmmakers have to anticipate putting together a backup plan so quickly. You can't just expect that some deal is going to magically appear a year from now, because it might, but it's going to suck. I think more importantly, what filmmakers need to be aware of, and this is maybe, you know, not necessarily for the bigger budgeted films that come in with, you know, international equity and you know, different states of leverage, but, you know, on the smaller scale, for a lot of the filmmakers in this room, and, you know, I'd be kind of curious to see what the demographic breakdown of this room is from, like, producers and filmmakers and just people at the Interactive milling about, but, you know, filmmakers need to be building their audience now at the fundraising level, and there's tools like Kickstarter that can allow that to happen. And what you're doing with the Kickstarter campaign, and what we see day in and day out in helping a lot of these filmmakers with their Kickstarter campaigns, is that they're building that audience. You know, the 500 or so backers that donate to your project, whether it's a dollar, whether it's $100, whether it's $5,000, have invested in your film. And I have a really bad habit of just kind of trolling the Kickstarter website, which tends to become a little bit worse after a beer or two, of just donating to random projects that I find intriguing, even if it's just a dollar. And even for these films that I've donated a dollar to, you better damn well believe that if that film comes to L.A., regardless of, you know, how good it is, I'm going to be front row center because I feel connected to it. I feel invested to it. And I think that that cultivation at the fundraising level is what you guys should be thinking about.
But I just want to add one thing. I mean, you should never go to a major festival with a film that you feel isn't ready. I mean, that you get one chance, really. I mean, I'm not saying you can't keep going to festivals and you might not get some interest and you probably will sell your film. Right now, every film seems to find some sort of distribution deal of some sort. But you don't get a second first time, so you shouldn't show films that you don't feel are right. I mean, there's examples out of Toronto this year that I'm not going to mention names, but they showed films that they went back and cut for 3 more months. Well, everyone saw it the first time, so you have to then twist the buyer's arms to watch that film again.
But ready means two different things now. Ready in terms of, yeah, have the film you want to have, but also I'm talking about this the social marketing leverage,
right. It's exactly what Chris said. It all depends on the level of the film, how big the film. I mean, if it has major movie stars on it, you don't need...
No. I'm talking about the indie, low-budget, a documentary, a real low-budget indie feature without that sales support and sales team that comes into a festival.
It's not going to be... It is a huge... For a distributor, say, of our size, we do look at Twitter numbers, and we look at Facebook, and we look at... But that's, we're not going to not buy a film we feel passionate about because they haven't got enough tweets around there.
What about you, Jason? How much is that built-in campaign add value for you as a distributor?
It all comes down to the film. I mean, not to simplify it horribly, but if the film is great, then the film is great. And if you've done zero stuff around it, I'm still going to want to buy it because it's a great film.
Right.
All right, well, we're halfway into the panel. If there's any questions, let's get to see where we go with these. There's a question up front. Just hang on for a second for the microphone. And where's the next question going to come from? Over here, if we can just get a microphone queued up there. Go ahead, sir.
Okay. First of all, thank you all for coming to South By. Y'all are all, you know, very, very strong individuals. I've actually spoken to Tom myself. It's crazy.
Very strong individual.
Yeah. I had a movie last year, Supernatural Activity. I don't know if you saw it. I'm a headhunter. I called every single, you know, large distributor, Magnolia. I talked to Tom when he was back over there. And, the first thing he said to me is, I caught him right before he was leaving work. He actually picked up the line. I was like, yes, okay, Tom Quinn. Blah, blah, blah. Hey, listen, my name's Derek Nixon. You know, I know I've got 10 seconds to pitch this guy on my movie of a spoof of Blair Witch Project, Paranormal Activity, Paranormal Activity
3. You also have 10 seconds to ask the question.
Okay. Anyway, so I have this movie that has the Hollywood structure. You know, three act, it's a spoof, Paranormal Activity 3 is coming out, boom. I send it over to Peter, and, you know, he watches, he calls me back. So I'm sitting here going after everybody, right? Well, we don't accept unsolicited material. We don't accept unsolicited material. I do my movie Wolf. It gets into South By. Preferred's calling me. Synetic. Everybody's calling me. How do we break the barrier of getting a good sales rep or having strong distributors look at our films without having to, you know, send in unsolicited material? What's I know
our
the festivals,
festival.
He's a film festival. He submits a film festival.
Our festivals are really the only gatekeepers for the independent. In your minds, are they your main filter, or are you looking elsewhere?
Well, I always think about, look, there are several levels of curation that happen in the process between you as a filmmaker ultimately getting to your audience, and a couple of levels of the curation are sales agents, film festivals. Ultimately, distributor would be the last one that happens there. And so, you know, there are a couple of ways that film festivals are still the most important place for distributors to go and find new product, without a doubt. However, look, there are agencies that set up screenings that have films that are not going to be in a film festival, but that's something that an agency or a sales agent or someone like that's going to do. But like Nancy says, I still believe that the film festival is the best place for you to try to premiere your film and the idea of it getting exposed and seen by distributors.
And not just any film festival, but probably a handful of film festivals that there's a critical mass of distributors at. Is that right?
Right, but buyers and sales agents, they need someone to watch the... We got 6,000 entries. Sundance gets 9,000. Someone has to do that job, and that's the job of film festivals currently, and that could change. But
so if I have another movie that has four wins on it, right, from small festivals like Starlight or Omaha, would you be willing to consider looking at the project with those wins, those laurels at the bottom, or would I need to be at a top five, like Tribeca, South By, Sundance, Toronto, Cannes?
Yeah.
Would
you consider looking at the
laurels?
To be horribly honest, the idea is if the film has not been at one of those top festivals, our automatic assumption is that it was you applied to it and didn't get in. And that's being horribly honest, but... maybe that's what I'm supposed to do.
Yeah, let's get a awesome mic. Thanks for that question. Let's get a mic over there, and in the meantime, we'll go here. So, someone raise your hand for a mic on that side. Go ahead.
Hi, guys. You talked a lot about multi-platform releases and VOD, and I'm just wondering, how do you make sure when you're marketing those films that you're breaking like the clutter of just the thousands of films that seem to be on the internet?
Yeah, that's
what are the goals, I guess, of a VOD release, like different from theatrical?
Yeah, Chris and Nancy, just in terms of leveraging your brand that way, how does that manifest itself on these various platforms?
Right. Well, we're really careful in putting together our digital deals in that our deals with iTunes, our deals with Amazon and Hulu are based around our branding. So, you know, the iTunes.com/Sundance, you know, URL will take you to an amazing Sundance room that we've been able to build that houses, you know, not only the films that we've been able to support through our initiative, but also through iTunes's and our, you know, curatorial involvement, films that are also up on the iTunes storefront that might be from Searchlight or Weinstein or Magnolia. So, you know, we accomplish that through sharing our brand with platforms, and we accomplish the messaging through a new tool that we've built called Now Playing. So if you guys go to sundance.org/nowplaying, it's a new website that we've actually built that can tell people where to go to find content digitally that we've been able to support through this initiative. So, you know, we accomplish it through our branding, but, you know, film specific.
So it's the same with Tribeca. So we as curators, we have one of the things that we do with our partners is, say, on Comcast, so there's a Tribeca tab, just like there is IFC or Sundance Select. And that's true basically across the board with all our partners, except Time Warner Cable. So if you're in the room, open up. And then the rest of the marketing is film specific, and we do a ton of obviously film specific marketing.
Do you have any tangible evidence that this has given a bump to some of the films that have gone through your branding on these various platforms? Is there any sense? How much are you tracking those numbers?
Well, we've only released films under our brand, so.
Oh, right.
And VOD numbers, the funny thing about the business is that VOD numbers are not reported publicly, so no one really knows how everyone else is doing.
Yeah, it's just one thing on that point. Tribeca's done a lot of really amazing things with the festival and with the distribution operation, but one of the things I think that you've done an incredible job at is the idea of building that brand. And that brand means something to people, and so I think our goal as distributors, and it is so incredibly difficult to do today, is that you give such a positive experience to the consumer that they want to come back and find out what else you have. And in the film distribution, or even the film business as a whole, the reality is, as far as actual brands are concerned, the number of brands that probably mean something to consumers, I would argue, is actually just probably one right now.
Disney?
Actually, no, it's at Pixar. I don't even think Disney.
Well, and
John Carter is proof of that. But
the other brand that actually is trying to build itself really up, is Focus. You notice that they brand everything now.
So, you know, that's our goal, ultimately, you know, and I know that we're obviously new, we haven't even released a film yet, but our goal, and I think everyone's goal as a distributor, is to try and put out products that get you as a consumer to say, hey, Tribeca, I really enjoyed that experience with you guys, so I want to come back and see what else you have. So I think the overall sort of the marketing and trying to get people to come back and check out your next film has a lot to do with your curation, the experience that you provided for the consumer, you know, all the normal things.
Well, we have a microphone over here. Go ahead.
For people who are doing really micro, low-budget movies, on the acquisition side, if you're using the festival strategy to launch a distribution, on the acquisition side, what draws your attention to a film at a festival? And then on the festival side, what do filmmakers need to do more of to, I guess, maximize the effect of the festival?
Two good questions. Jason, we'll put the first one to you. What are you looking for as an acquisitions executive at a film festival? Then we'll ask about some tips for filmmakers.
Well, as far as putting together our initial slate, we've sort of set aside and said, look, there are a certain types of films that we want to make sure that we put into our slate as a whole. And again, to be horribly blunt, the idea of having, you know, A or B list, at least talent in a lot of the films, that's really important, especially to trying to compete on the level that we're going to be competing on. But the goal in the long run is that by being able to do a number of these films and do them well, that will also provide us opportunities to work on films that for whatever reason, we're drawn to specifically and said, wow, that's something that I really love. Tom, when we were at Magnolia, Tom fell in love with a film called Woman, Thou Art Loosed, which was a small sort of African-American drama that involved a Reverend T.D. Jakes. And he was like, this is an amazing film. And it was out of the traditional festival circuit. It was the whole bit. And he was like, I want to somehow get this up into screens. And so he had a chance to buy it. And the film actually performed really, really well. And so it's our goal is to be able to find films, and that's just one example, that we actually that touches us in some way and we want to bring to the public at large. But the reality is we're only able to do those if we have a lot of the other ones that sort of cover the ability for us to continue to be a viable and successful distributor.
Will you guys do documentaries? I'm just asking that for my personal account.
Yes, we definitely want to do documentaries. However, documentaries are tricky right now, and there are certain types of docs I go and see documentaries at film festivals that I know I'm never even going to have a chance at buying, because it just won't work for what we're doing, but I love docs so much that I'm going to actually go see them anyway. But yes, at somewhere down the line, we don't have any docs right now, but somewhere down the line we will get back to buying some docs.
And,
awesome.
And I would say, you know, using the festival as you know, to shape your strategy for how you would ultimately go about getting distribution if you're that sort of micro-budget film. You know, and again, I think it's really different whether you're a narrative or a documentary. You know, if documentaries actually have really strong life on digital platforms. And I think that's because a lot of docs tend to be about niche subjects, and you know, you can go onto iTunes and see what some of the top performing documentaries are, and these are not exactly, you know, the works of cinematic auteurs, let's be fair. And, you know, the reason is because a lot of the filmmakers you know, have built-in constituencies and groups and organizations that, even if it's the worst film about a certain subject, the people who are completely devoted and invested and are steeped in the life of whatever that subject is, whether it's, you know, whether it's food, whether it's, you know, whether it's sports, whether it's, you know, bee colony collapse disorder, you're going to have an identifiable audience. And the more cultivation you can do around that for your film, that will, you know, sort of shape how you can go about your distribution strategy. On the narrative side, for lower budgeted films, it's a little bit harder. And I think what you have to take a look at is, you know, number one, assuming that at your first festival screening, whether it's South By, Tribeca, Sundance, that it's not going to be sort of the, you know, the open bidding war that, you know, that it used to be, you know, a few years ago. And what you have to do is take a pretty sober, clinical look at what your likely windowing is going to be. You know, is this a theatrical film? Can I live without a theatrical? And because distribution is becoming increasingly complex and specialized, so too are distributors. And there's certain distributors that, you know, like Tribeca or like IFC, like Magnolia, like Radius, can focus on multi-platform strategies. There's other smaller niche art house distributors that can do a smaller theatrical, you know, and maybe give you the ability to retain ownership of, you know, of certain other, you know, windows as well, depending on how those rights get licensed. So you really have to look at what the windowing likelihood is for that specific film.
One quick point. At film festivals, you just have to remember that their film festival, I'm sorry, that distribution acquisition executives are seeing like 6 movies a day. And after a while, it becomes a real grind. You have a film that means something and is different and is this incredible story, well told. It could be the smallest thing in the world, but these people, like, it stands out. And they'll see it and go, wow, I want to do something with this. So,
Nancy, what's your single most important piece of advice for a truly independent filmmaker coming to a festival and being able to leverage that for the commercial life of their film? What's the key thing they have to know?
Well, I mean, I say this kind of stuff to filmmakers all the time. You can't be, I mean, Chris was talking about how you have to look at your own film with a real hard eye. I mean, you have to know what you're going for, and then you have to go for it. I mean, you get this one opportunity, really. So you to get your film into a festival, you should call programmers. They have phones. They'll pick them up. So call them. Say, I want you to watch my film. Don't be too aggressive, or that'll piss them off. But when you get into the festival, you know, do everything you can. Get friends to put out flyers. Get, you know, make sure you have an audience there. Call the festival before and say, are my screenings sold out? I need to make sure my screenings are sold out. And then try to work the sales agent angle if you can get a sales agent. It depends on how big your film is or how small. But, you know, make sure that buyers are in the audience. Make sure that people are seeing the film as you want it seen.
If we have a question here, let's get a mic over back there. Go ahead, let's go to the back of the room. I just have one quick question. Hopefully it's quick. We're talking about distribution. Do you see festivals consolidating their brands in terms of creating an exhibition circuit in North America? I know Sundance just has a festival in London. Tribeca has a festival in Doha.
Yeah,
do you see that happen? Do you see a kind of branded circuit of festivals happening in North America?
We just did a thing last year called Tribeca on the Road. We did it with American Express. We went to 4 cities and actually Sundance does this too. We went to 4 cities, San Francisco, Chicago, outside New York City in New Jersey, which is not really a city. Sorry, I'm totally blanking on what the city was in New Jersey. And Houston, and we showed 6 films. Amex helped bring in the filmmakers. We did a whole Q&A experience. I mean, it was a film festival experience. I don't know how, that's very hard to pull off, but that it would be a goal for us, certainly, because it's really great for the films and really great for the brand.
Do you see this? I know a lot of filmmakers are interested in doing event screenings, et cetera. Do you see artist services supplying those kinds of bookings or creating a Sundance kind of circuit through the U.S. or North America?
Ultimately, absolutely. I mean, I think that if you look at our sort of 3-year plan, theatrical is certainly a part of that. And, you know, how can we do it, like with the other deals that we've done, by striking creative partnerships that can open up new ways for filmmakers to tap into that theatrically? And I think, you know, one of the cool things about Artist Services is that it, you know, sort of represents this big push for the Institute to brand itself as a 365-day-a-year platform. Because, you know, during the 2 weeks in January, even my grandmother knows what Sundance is. But, you know, we are a 365-day-a-year full-fledged nonprofit arts organization that puts on content year-round. And the type of projects, and just to show you how wonderful this ecosystem can be, you know, there's a film, an amazing documentary called Semper Fi that was produced by our documentary film program that played Tribeca. It didn't play Sundance, and that's actually one of the films that's taking advantage of our distribution arrangement. And so it just kind of shows you how mingled and diverse these opportunities can be. So certainly, you know, we see Artist Services being sort of the way that we can brand that 365 day a year.
Do you see independent filmmakers that again have maintained those rights or theatrical rights and go through any kinds of circuits you might create? Do you see them sharing in those revenues very actively? In other words, I mean, festivals don't usually pay screening fees, at least not major festivals, but you see filmmakers being able to tap into some kind of festival circuit as a viable way to generate theatrical revenue for their films?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think even more important to that, and maybe to go back to your point, yeah, I think for a lot of small films that are out there, you have to anticipate that traditional theatrical distribution is not going to happen. In that, to embrace the fact that your festival trajectory, whether you premiere at Sundance or Tribeca or South By, and then go on to, you know, 10 or 15 other regional festivals throughout the calendar year, that is your theatrical, and you will never get more favorable audiences. You will never have better, warmer Q&As, and you actually will fill seats. And to me, you know, I'm not a filmmaker, so I can't speak from this experience, but you know, I would much rather have that than to rent out the Cinema Village in New York and pay money to do it and have eight people go see it.
Should they be
just
asked
for a little New York Times review that's, you know, lumped in with 13 other Times reviews on the Friday when it's released?
Should they be asking for screening fees then?
I think it's fair.
Okay. In the back, we have a microphone. Someone, go ahead. Sorry, I cut you off.
Hi. I was wondering, you mentioned when you were at Magnolia, you were...
So you're going to have to speak louder, ma'am. We can't hear you.
Sorry, you mentioned when you were at Magnolia, you played around with experimenting with different platforms and different times of releasing the film, maybe releasing it before the theatrical release, and that you'd found a successful model. And I wondered about that.
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. I had that question, too. You said at Magnolia you were playing around with experimentation, day and date, et cetera, and that you'd found a model that works. What was that model?
Well, I mean, it's the model that Magnolia... I mean, Magnolia has been very successful the past couple of years doing the ultra VOD model, which is the idea of releasing a film on VOD several weeks prior to it being made available in theaters. That's the model that they do. One of the things that Tom and I are doing at Radius is we're not a one-size-fits-all model. We're sort of matching up the way we're going to release these films based upon what we think makes the most sense for each particular film. So some of those films, yes, they might sort of have that same... it's called Ultra VOD now, which was actually a phrase that was coined by my old boss, Mark Cuban, that everyone seems to be using now, which is kind of hilarious. But we'll be doing some of those films. We'll be doing some films that will be going, I guess, day and date, which is similar to what happened with Margin Call last year. And we also believe in the idea of doing a clean theatrical release maybe for a week or two before going on VOD, because some films make sense to actually have a bit of a theatrical release, but you don't want to lose the momentum and still make it available on VOD. So for us, we continue sort of the idea in our heads of how can we continue to help this model evolve, because, again, going back to my original point, as people who came up in the specialty film business, we want to see these films continue to be made and be successful. And so we're willing to try, I think, virtually anything that will allow that to continue, and hopefully sort of the viability of the independent film, specialty film, whatever you want to call it.
Hey, Jason, will you guys be doing anything similar on the actual Weinstein or Dimension branding on that sort of day-and-date model, or would it all flow through Radius?
Everything's flowing through Radius. There are reasons for that, but yeah.
Okay.
Sounds like more of a sort of bespoke distribution model.
I like that. Bespoke.
Yeah, you can use it.
Bespoke.
You can
We're
use
actually
it.
Releasing our first Ultra right now with Detachment. It's on VOD.
Bespoke, not Ultra. Bespoke.
It's, no. it's bespoke, yeah. So we're doing it right now. It's the first time. I'll let you guys know how it goes.
Yeah, let us know. Someone over here have a microphone? Go ahead in the front here, sir. And then let's get a microphone over there, too. You got one? Okay, go ahead.
Sort of a follow-up to the date and demand, just the general models. Is there any sort of consensus or numbers in terms of how that stuff either affects I know people are squeamish about how that can affect the theatrical release, so right. That's part of it. And then also just how it affects the overall revenue as a whole.
Well, I guess I don't understand. Affects the overall revenue.
I guess what I'm saying is there a consensus that ultimately, hey, this film has made more money because of this, because we did VOD pre-theatrical or at the same time? I guess
which is ultimately the goal.
Yeah, that's the point.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, look, obviously this doesn't apply to everything, but I think that for a lot of films, especially films that have gone through that particular release model, the short answer is yes.
Okay, there it is.
Let me just say something about VOD. So we understand there's different price points for different, where they are in the process. So Ultra, Magnolia gets $9.99. And then when it's day and date with theatrical, it's $4.99 or $5.99, whatever. It depends on HD or not HD. And then when it's post-theatrical or during the theatrical, it's $2.99. So the whole point of the Magnolia model was to push where the money's actually being made for films is on VOD right now. So the whole point was to push that model and push that window and see what they could get out of these titles. Because theatrical, I mean, let's be honest, it loses tons of money. So you guys have to realize that no one's going to want to theatrically release small films. There's no benefit except to get the price point up on VOD. That's what you're pushing for.
But that's why I think the margin call model is such a great one. And why
margin call. Sorry.
Because I think it's a game changer in a lot of ways. Because again, day and date is not for every film, but for margin call, it worked, and there's a lot of reasons for that. But at that particular budget level, of course, the distributors are taking a big risk in doing that. But what it also allows the distributor to do is to consolidate the marketing campaigns and to spend according to that simultaneous windowing. Because if they had spent the same amount, and it's very likely they would, for just a theatrical release, I guarantee you, Margin Call would have had the exact same per screen average if it was released theatrically only. And it happened to do pretty damn well that opening weekend. And so therefore, the distributors aren't, based on the law of averages, suffering from a pretty poor theatrical showing and then spending worse when it comes time to release the DVD and the VOD, and therefore the film suffers as a result. So what you're doing is sort of consolidating the push, consolidating the noise, consolidating the awareness. And I went and saw Margin Call in theaters that opening weekend because I wanted to see a movie in the theater. And it's just that type of movie.
And following up on both of those points, if we're talking about revenue, you can make an argument that Margin Call, had it gone the Ultra model, it probably would have made more money. Because that's 4 weeks worth of VOD at the highest price point that they gave up.
Which is that now in theaters? Is that now in theaters?
Actually, before it's in theaters.
Oh, before? Pre-theater.
So, I mean, look, obviously, in hindsight, it's easy for us to pick apart all of this. And we're continuing to learn and continuing to try and, do what we can together.
Probably time for a couple more questions. Go ahead in the back.
Hi. I have a VOD service in Mexico that is trying to reach the Mexican and Latin American market, and we are trying to work with festivals locally and internationally. In your experience, which is a good way to create synergy between a VOD service that creates value for the festival, the service, and the public?
Good question for Nancy.
I'm confused. Where are the festivals? Are the festivals in Mexico, or are the festivals in, where are they?
Well, we're starting with Mexican film festivals because no Mexican film festival has digital extension. They only have websites with programming and stuff, but their movies are not available digitally because we don't have VOD services in Mexico. Netflix just entered last September, but they have a tiny catalog, and it's mostly blockbusters, so there's no service online that is legal and accessible about alternative films.
Well, so you should approach the festivals and work with them. The Amsterdam Film Week, which I don't know if you guys have heard of because it just started last year, they approached Tribeca last year for some title recommendations. They didn't need to be new titles. They were putting them in Amsterdam Film Week, and they wanted some titles that we had shown in the festival the year before, the half year prior. And so we curated four films for them, and they went out and got the VOD rights for, I don't know what part of Europe, but for whatever region they were working in, and they showed them simultaneously on there with the VOD cable channel that they had worked out a deal with. So, I mean, I think that if you talk to the festivals, it's good for the films, and it's good for the festival. So
the basic structure is, how can you leverage your branding and curation to help the commercial life of a film on various platforms. And that value exchange is complicated. It's not always revenues.
Right. You're also getting don't own rights to film.
Yeah, you're also getting a branding push on the Tribeca and Sundance brands. The films are getting a value bump by being associated with those brands and tapping into a larger audience.
It's a complicated deal, yeah. but our as a festival curator, our role wasn't doing the deal making. The Amsterdam Film Week took on that role, and we were just curators for them.
Yeah,
but it was good for our films and good for Amsterdam Film Week and good for everyone.
It's kind of a marketing exchange. Go over here, please. Someone have a microphone on this side, and then we'll get one more over there. And then I think that'll be it, folks. Yeah, go ahead.
I am curious, especially with Sundance, but maybe all of you have something to say about the direct-to-fan portion of distribution also.
Sorry, the direct-to... Mm-hmm.
Direct-to-consumer.
Oh.
You know, we're a distribution company. We have a new video alliance and mm-hmm. et cetera. But we started and our core is direct-to-fan. And so I'm just curious.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we were really smart in... trying to get ahead of that, and we actually struck a deal with Topspin Media, which can provide some unique opportunities for Sundance artists who are interested in Topspin. And for those who don't know, Topspin is essentially software that focuses on direct-to-fan management. And I think that this is a major part, this will ultimately be a major part of how films get distributed from the self-distribution creative level, because whether you want to sell digital downloads directly by using their software, whether you want to sell merchandise like T-shirts or bumper stickers or whatever that that bands and that music as a model has been doing for years, but that film is still far behind in, then they give you that opportunity to do that. That can happen on a very big level, like with what Kevin Smith did on Red State, or it can happen on a very small level. There's a film that. That played our festival a year ago called On the Ice, and actually that film was able to raise about $85,000 to fund a self-release theatrical through our Kickstarter involvement, but they're also booking their screenings, they're also selling merchandise, collector's edition DVDs, through Topspin software on their own website, and it's this beautiful layout. I really do think that that is the future of physical ownership, and I think that the studios... are sort of grasping at straws in a lot of ways with the ultraviolet model, and I'd be curious what Janego thinks about that. But, ownership is not going to come from the cloud. I think that Netflix streaming and Hulu and, this a la carte model, or rather not a la carte, but, all-you-can-eat model of streaming consumption for movies is changing the way that consumers look at ownership. And so if I'm a filmmaker, not only do I have to anticipate that, I also have to think about, how do I sell a really sweet collector's edition DVD that I might sign and print myself and make myself, and I could raise $4,000 on Kickstarter to do that, and it's clean and it's beautiful. That becomes a collector's edition. So I think that direct-to-fan model, and Topspin does it better than anybody, is really sort of the gravy on the meat and potatoes of this digital distribution revolution.
And Gary Huswood did a good job with the design trilogy in that regard by creating that through that box set, and that was really, really nice. One last question over there. Go ahead.
Real quick question. I missed the first half of this, so you might have talked about this already, but I've heard you say something about getting named talent in regards to getting better luck at getting distributors to take you more seriously, maybe if you have some named talent in there. I'm getting ready to go into production, and I've been going back and forth with the producers about maybe putting a few names in, sort of maybe B-level type of actors, but the argument that some producers are throwing is preconceived notions of that actor or actress and may shy away certain people and this and that. If we have the ability to get who myself as a director likes in that part, no matter who it is, if they're saying there's preconceived notions, is it a better thing than if I have no name talent in there? Is it always good to...
I would say, Jason, answer that question. You want to re-answer it?
Obviously, every situation is very specific and different. But as a distributor, it's a lot easier for me to sell an audience on people that they already know, as opposed to trying to sell them new faces that they've never heard before. But if the performances by these new faces are so incredible, and so I think about the movie Swingers, for those of you who are old enough to remember Swingers. You know, that was a group of people who were all friends and said, hey, let's get together and make a movie. And from that movie, that's anywhere between 6 and 10 people who you see on your movie screen like every single time you go to the theater. So, you know, it depends on where I guess you are. If you find that group of people and you're one of them, then, you know, make it happen.
Well, Chris, Nancy, Jason, lots of interesting things happening in all your various endeavors, lots of opportunities, also some complexity and challenges. Thanks so much for sharing this information with us. Hopefully it was useful for you guys, and continue to have a great South By, folks.